Lead, follow, or get out of the way. General George Patton said that during the Second War. Lee Iacocca, the president of Chrysler Corporation in the 70s, said the same thing. Those are not the only two people that have used those words. There have been others. But they sort of catch your attention. Lead, follow, or get out of the way. Very simple approach to life. However, these words reflect the tension and the ambiguity that has persisted in nations, institutions, towns, families for centuries. Those words are set at kitchen tables. Those words are set where diplomats meet. Those words are set in the speeches given in countries. Particularly when leaders rise and they look out over the crowd. Lead, that's what I'm going to do. Follow, that's what you're going to do. And if not, get out of the way. Pretty clear, quite brutal. But it does reflect tension and ambiguity. What am I to do with that? I don't understand what it means to lead. I'm not sure what it means to follow. I have a hunch as to what it means to get out of the way. The church is not exempt from this tension, by the way. John Stott, in his book on leadership, writes this. There is painful tension between what the church claims to be and what the church seems to be. Between the divine ideal and the human reality. Between the romantic talk about the church being the bride of Christ and the very unromantic, ugly, unholy, and quarrelsome Christian community we know ourselves to be. It is this tension between the final glorious destiny in heaven and our present very inglorious performance on earth that we pay attention to. It is this ambiguity that is present in the church. End quote. You don't say that at a tea party, by the way. It's hard to receive what Stott put forward in the year 2002. What were you doing 2002? What was church life like for all of us in 2002? What were the historic waves that were moving back and forth in church life in 2002? Or if you can't draw on that, draw on another year. Draw on this year. Maybe Stott had something to say about this year as well as 2002. Throughout history, humans have contended with the ambiguity that presents itself in four ways. One is power. I have the power, and I'm going to use the power, and we're going to eliminate the ambiguity. And if you are the ambiguity, we're going to eliminate you. Power. It's very simple. Coercion. Then there's control. Control is more limited in terms of, I think I control my stuff. And maybe I need to control a little bit of your stuff, but that's about as far as I can go. But it's control, It's an aspect of power. Then there's compliance. Whatever you want, I'll do. It's fine. I don't want to be disturbed. I don't like the ambiguity of not knowing. And so we become compliant. And then there's the fourth one. Cooperation. It's a way to deal with ambiguity. Cooperation. So this tension that we experience in our institutions, the church being one of them, is not new. The Apostle Paul dealt with it in the Corinthian letter, the first chapter, which was read today. Jesus dealt with it straight up and straight on when he walked this earth. He had words to say about this ambiguity, this tension, this way that we're going to organize our life using what? Power, control, compliance, cooperation. Jesus had something to say about that. Jesus, however, provides a pattern for leadership that is counter-culture. Just doesn't seem to fit. He leads by serving. Jesus, there's something wrong with the pattern there. Leaders do not serve. They are served. And Jesus says, no. I came into your life. I came into this world. I came into the universe to serve, to be a servant. And I'm calling you, Peter, James, John, Bartholomew, the whole group of you, I'm calling you to serve. Well, Jesus, you know, we're not high on the social pecking order, but you know, that service thing rubs me the wrong way. I live in a community that is run by the Romans that are telling me that we have to serve them. I don't like that. And I don't like the way the religious leaders are making their way towards Rome. And now you're saying we need to serve. I'll think about that. And then Jesus says, follow me. And Matthew gets up from his counting desk and says, yeah, I heard that. I'll follow. James and John, you take care of the nets. And they follow. What was the dynamic? What turned the switch so that they could hear what Jesus was saying? It's rather fascinating that this servant leadership theme that Jesus lives out is picked up by two authors, and you would say, why would they take Jesus as the model for leadership? One of them is Robert Greenleaf. He writes in 1969 a book that's about this thick. He was 45 years a middle manager in AT&T. And he began to look at AT&T, this big institution. And he was saying, you know, something's wrong the way we work. We have people who are over here, and we have people who are over here, and they don't seem to talk. These people over here don't know about these people over here, and vice versa. There's something wrong with the pattern. And he spent years trying to decipher what it was in American culture as seen in AT&T that's on the wrong trail. Title of his book, servant leadership. The servant in the leadership model is the one that understands the other person. The person who is other from you. It is not focusing on me, it's focusing on the other person. And when that happens, when your eyes get open and your ears get open, you see and you hear, there is an empathic response to that individual. And Greenleaf, when he left AT&T, was acknowledged as the guru of a new leadership plan. You can still pick up his book. People still read that book. They're fascinated by that book. And Jesus is the model, hovering throughout that book. Not explicit, but very clear. In the 80s, another person, president of the Herman Miller Furniture Company, Max Dupré, he writes three books. And he's trying to solve a similar situation to what Greenleaf was. He writes The Art of Leadership. And then he writes Leadership and All That Jazz. And then he writes Servant Leadership. Herman Miller Furniture, big company. Dupré was a appreciated and revered leader. In his first book, The Art of Leadership, he says there are three things that the leader has to do. Define reality. The third thing the leader needs to do is say, thank you. And the second thing the leader needs to do is to help the other person succeed. Meet the other person where he or she is. The art of leadership. And Dupré tells many stories. Once this idea began to percolate in his system as a person and in the business as an institution, it revolutionized the way Herman Miller Furniture functioned. The leader declaring what's real and not in ambiguous terms. But at all times, the leader expressing gratitude to the other. And in between, reaching out, how can I help? What do you need in order to accomplish your task? What would happen if the president of an institution decided to do that? In a strange way, Abraham Lincoln was one of those. Very often, Lincoln went out the back door of the presidential house and met people. So here's this scheme that is there, this leadership and the ambiguity that we struggle with in the church, because we find that there are leaders that always want to be on the ascendancy. They want to be heard. They want to be followed, but you've got to do it on my words. They don't understand cooperation. And that creates the tension in the life of the church, and always has. And Paul is confronted with that at the Corinthian church. Factions had arisen. How do you go through that swamp? The Apostle Paul challenges the notion of power. as the approach to leadership. And he starts off by saying, first of all, Corinthians, you need to get it straight. Power belongs to God. That's it, simple. I don't have anything more to say. Now, if you want to talk about that, I'm happy to talk about that. But power belongs to God. So each time that you have a desire to seize the power, to get involved in coercive activity, to get involved in complicit activity, you then have turned your back on God, you're walking away, you're not following. Ooh, Paul, that's rather severe. And Paul, as the rabbi, could bring out example after example where power belongs to God. And then Paul looks at the Corinthians and he says, why do you denigrate yourselves? Why do you badmouth yourselves? Why do you express yourselves in ways that bring on, oh, person's a loser. Why do you do that? And that was a very important conversation that Paul had with the Corinthian church, because they were constantly deprecating themselves. I have nothing to say, I have nothing to do, I can't do anything, on and on and on it went. And then Paul says, with Jesus, the way things happen, the weak become strong by the power of God. God takes all of that which is weak and transforms it into that which has a power about it. That's not just taking Dale Carnegie and saying, you know, you can all do good stuff, kumbaya, let's have a great time. He's not saying that. He's saying if you're a follower of Jesus, this one who died on the cross, if you are a follower of Jesus who spoke to people where they were, if you are a follower of Jesus who touched the people in all of their sicknesses, in all of those moments where they were just filled with the remorse of life, and Jesus touched them, he's the one who is saying, follow me. He knows about all of that, and he wants you to be a part of this, which is the revealing of the power of God in the presence of other people. The notion for power, however, was extent. The Greeks, they believed that power was communicated by wisdom. All the wise sayings emerge out of the Greeks, and they were filled with that, and that's how they worked their life. Oh, yes, there was Alexander the Great, Philip of Macedon. There was the Greek Empire. Yes, there was force, coercion. Yes, and all that control and the rest. But the Greeks, they felt they could talk with you and use rhetoric and solve your problem. The Romans had a different approach, and it definitely was coercion. And the Jews had the sense that they had the monopoly on God. The Greeks and the Romans had nothing to do with God. We'll let them be. We know who God is, and we're going to tell you in no uncertain terms. And that's the end of the story. So here Paul is living in this cauldron of power grabbers, the Greeks, the Romans, and the Jews. And Paul says, all that I have to tell you is the cross of Christ, is the display of God's power wrapped in love. That's all I have to tell you. Nothing in my hands I bring, simply to thy cross I cling. Paul didn't write those words. That's a hymn. Third stanza of Rock of Ages. Nothing in my hands I bring, says Paul, but simply to the cross I cling. Humans have been clamoring and grasping for power since the Garden of Eden. Jesus refused to receive power from Satan in the wilderness and said, "No, I'm not going down that road." He gave himself to the ultimate weakness of the cross. And that is so counterintuitive. It was back in the first century, and it continues to be to this day. On Wednesday, 23 years ago, two World Trade Towers were hit, beginning at 8:46. Within 2 hours, those two towers collapsed and formed what we now know as the pile. By the end of the day, two more hijacked planes had crashed. And when the sun had set, about 3,000 people had died. That's power. That's raw power. And our country was stunned. You can probably remember where you were. Michael Judge was a Franciscan priest. He was the head chaplain of the New York Fire Department. On that day, he and the chief and a few other firefighters were in the lobby of the South Tower. Michael was giving last rites to a person who had been seriously, mortally injured. And as he bent down to give last rites, a piece of concrete hit him. And he fell flat. It was a mortal wound. His colleagues in the fire department carried him to an ambulance, and he died. Why did Michael die? I don't have an answer to that. It's just a question that haunts me. Here is this Franciscan priest who has given his life into this milieu. And he dies. As I begin to become familiar with Michael through things that he had written and people that had written about him, I began to see something. Michael, after he was a priest, he began to understand what his ordination vows really meant. And he gave a witness to the fact that he is more interested in that person to whom he is connected than he is interested in himself. For Michael, following Jesus was the way his life had to be lived. Every day, something would occur. Oh Lord, where do you want me to go? Oh Lord, what do you want me to say? That was his prayer. He had come to understand this leadership issue because he pledged himself to be a follower of Jesus. And in so doing, he led. Michael Judd, when they were going through his effects at the firehouse, they found a wallet. Evidently, when he went off on a call, he would place this wallet, which had his money in the locker. And then there was another in his effects. And so people went through it. They wanted to find out, okay, what is here for us? This is what they found. It was a prayer that he wrote very early on. And I found out when I was officiating at a funeral down at Arlington 3 years ago. I happened to mention Michael Judd to a school teacher of a parochial school. "Oh, I know Michael." I said, "How do you know Michael?" "Well, I really don't know Michael. I mean, he died." I said, "Well, how do you know him, though?" "He would visit the school." "Oh, really? Do you know his prayer, Dean?" I said, "As a matter of fact, I do. We have it on the wall in the school." "Oh." This follower of Christ made it outside the firehouse, outside the monastery, into the world with the cross of Christ. This is Michael's prayer. "Lord, take me where you want me to go. Let me meet the people you want me to meet. Tell me what you want me to say, and keep me out of your way. Amen." I printed these up. They're on the back table if you'd like to grab one. I keep one. I find a kinship with Michael. Certainly as a military chaplain, I can empathize with him. But more than that, he was a follower who led and invited and gathered and worked cooperatively. He understood power, but did not use it to overwhelm the other. Lord, take me where you want me to go. Let me meet the people you want me to meet. Tell me what you want me to say, and keep me out of your way. Amen.